Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, everyone. I'd like to welcome all of you back to Ohio Exopolitics. I'm your host, Mark Snyder, and our guest this evening is Dave Gardner. He has several interesting websites, I do believe. One of them is called worldpopulationbalance.org, and we are going to be talking about probably the world's biggest problem that very few people know anything about. So I'd like to welcome Dave to the show. Dave, how are you this evening?
I'm great. Thanks for having me on, Mark.
My pleasure, sir. I'm going to dive right in. Can you tell our listeners a little bit about yourself, how you got interested in the overpopulation problem?
Sure. In a nutshell, I'm probably a longtime conservationist and pretty strong conservation and environmental ethic, but only about 10 years ago did I really get activated around the subject of overpopulation, and it started with my concerns about what my own community, my hometown, was doing, was worshiping and pursuing population growth under the misguided notion that somehow that was necessary for community and individual prosperity. But once I started investigating that subject, I soon found that it was really a worldwide problem. So it's definitely macro and micro, this subject of overpopulation. And I eventually decided to produce a documentary about the subject, and while I was working on the documentary, I met David Paxson, who founded World Population Balance, and became quite a fan of his, because this was one of the smartest people in the sustainable population movement, who has been in the game for a quarter of a century and really knows his stuff. And so I was honored to be asked to serve as executive director of World Population Balance about a year ago, when David decided it was time for him to scale back a little bit.
What is the name of your documentary?
The documentary is called Growth Busters, Hooked on Growth. I have a little bit of schizophrenia here. I actually manage two different nonprofits. I started a nonprofit called Citizen Powered Media to produce that documentary, Growth Busters, and I continue to be president of that nonprofit, doing a lot of it. Public education and outreach around the subject of limits to growth, but at the same time, I divide my time and I work specifically just on the overpopulation issue as executive director of World Population Balance.
So you have another organization, it's called Citizens Power and Media. I find that really interesting. Can you tell us a little bit about that too?
Yeah, I'll tell you real quickly, and mainly it's known for its Growth Busters project. So most people know it as Growth Busters.
Mm-hmm.
If you visited growthbusters.org or growthbustersmovie.com, you would find it. And that really explores takes a little bit more holistic approach to our sustainability crisis. And it explores overpopulation, and it also explores overconsumption and economic growth. So while World Population Balance focuses really on the population side of the sustainability equation, Growth Busters expands that a little bit, and in recognition of the fact that our impact on the planet, the scale of the human enterprise, if you're evaluating our impact on the planet, it's really the product of how many of us there are times the way we're behaving or the size of our economy. So both of those factors, economic activity and size of our population, kind of get together to gang up on the natural world. And truth be known, the reason I work more than full-time for both of these organizations working on that is because we have become so big, the human enterprise, that we are injuring the planet's ability to just to provide for our needs. We're actually damaging our life support systems. And each year, the planet is less able to provide for us than it was the year before.
Have you ever met Frosty Wooldridge?
I have. I know Frosty.
Excellent. That's good. Yeah. I got his book, America on the Brink. And he's been on the show several times. He's another person that is really clued in on the whole overpopulation thing.
Frosty is very passionate about that.
He is. And I'm hoping to get him back on the show soon, too. I think he was driving around the world on a bike, or he takes these unbelievable, maybe not all the way around the world, but he takes these incredible trips on bikes for months and stuff. So I don't hear from him for a while. But one of the things I thought was very interesting on your website, it says that there are 140 people born every minute. That's about 8,400 per hour and over 200,000 per day. That's almost inconceivable. I wondered if you could talk about that a little bit.
Well, it is something that it's kind of out of sight, out of mind. So, you know, because wherever you are in the course of your day, unless you're working in a labor and delivery room, you don't see the addition at all. But, of course, you'd have to be working in all the labor and delivery rooms across the globe to really see the full impact of what we're adding to the planet every day. And I think it works out to, it's over 4 million people a week that we add. That is the net addition to the population. So it's significant. It's huge. And we're at about 7.4 billion today. We were at 2 billion early in the last century. We were just really barely above a billion. So we're kind of if you look at a graph of the population growth of the human species over the long history that we've been around, it looks like a hockey stick. We were pretty low in numbers really until just 100 years ago, and because of the really just the mathematics of exponential growth, we just took off. We're like, you know, some kind of a virus or bacteria in a petri dish.
So are we at exponential growth right now?
Well, we have been all along. Basically, what exponential growth means is that it just means that it's not linear. It means that the growth in this minute is really based on how many of us there were a minute before. Because you know, you need a couple of human beings to get together in order to make another one. I think you've heard that probably somewhere. The birds and the bees. So the number of us that are on the planet now definitely has an impact on how many new ones we're making. If there were very few of us, we wouldn't be able to make that many. It would take years and years for us to build up our population. So that's the nature of exponential growth. You take you have two this year, and they basically double in some amount of time. And for a long time, human population was for the last 100 years or so, we were doubling the population on the planet. Gosh, you know, in less than a century, you know, many times every century, and that was only because we had finally achieved, you know, such huge numbers that huge numbers that it was noticeable. It wasn't really noticeable if you had 10 million people spread around the whole planet one year, and the next year there were 20 million people. It wasn't a big deal. But when you got into the billions, suddenly there's no place, you know, there's no place left to put anybody. Have you got any open lanes on the freeway where you live that are just begging for some more people in rush hour?
You know, that's where you can see it. That's where I think people can see it. It is like every day we have to deal with rush hour and just these huge amounts of traffic. But, you know, people, they don't think of it as a population. They think of it as there's not enough lanes on the freeway. You know what I mean?
I do.
So we ought to be thinking of it. We should be thinking of it in different terms, right? I mean,
well, we tend not to think about the root cause for a number of reasons that we can certainly get into if you'd like. But we do look at the downstream impacts. So we look at the traffic congestion, and we try to solve traffic congestion problems by adding more lanes. Yeah, we look at hunger, world hunger, and we try to solve world hunger by shipping food around, you know, halfway around the planet. We don't try to solve either one of those problems by saying, wow, maybe there's too many of us. We look at, you know, air pollution. We look at greenhouse gas emissions. And very rarely do we talk about how maybe if we had fewer carbon emitters, we wouldn't have a climate disruption challenge. That just, for some reason, we're a little blind to that. And it's a real, really, it's a complex set of reasons that keep us from looking at the root cause.
You know, and I think that adding food to a group of people who cannot feed themselves, I think, can exacerbate the problem. I don't know, like if you go in Africa and there's, you know, certain areas where people, there's so many people and they can't, they've had a population boom and they can't really feed themselves. So we go in there and we just give them all this food and then we leave. And then they reproduce, and now there's more of them, and then they got an even bigger problem sometimes. Would you agree with that or not?
Oh, yeah, that's a tough one. It's one of the many reasons that we don't tend to talk about overpopulation, because that sounded, you know, it sounds a little cruel to say, wow, maybe we shouldn't be, you know, be humanitarians and try to keep people from starving. But if we could kind of step back and look at the problem for 40,000 feet and look at it just as biologists, let's say, then we would certainly say, yeah, there's every population of every species, that the natural state of things is for it to expand until it, you know, until there's a few more in population than the ecosystem in which it lives can provide for it. And then, you know, Mother Nature takes its course, and some of them die back until there's, you know, a more manageable population. So it's a kind of a constant state of flux. But, you know, the amount of food rules. It governs how many deer there are in a, you know, on an island or in a, you know, in any ecosystem. And human beings are subject to all of the same rules, except that we're, you know, we're smart enough, if you want to call it that, or advanced enough that we can sort of mess around with Mother Nature. So if there's a population in an area that has exceeded its carrying capacity, what do? We do. We put a bunch of grain on ships and we ship it down there. And that does, unfortunately, enable that population to sort of defy the laws of nature and keep on multiplying when, if nature was left to take its course, of course, there would be. Unfortunately, some people would starve and the population would contract.
You know, part of the problem, I think, is what you said, the laws of nature. We don't have a good handle on the laws of nature. One thing that we do, I think, that is really bad is the way we just knock down trees. And I read on your website that we are losing a forested area the size of Ohio, something like every year. That's unbelievable.
Yeah, and that's another out of sight, out of mind kind of thing that, you know, you don't see it. It's not happening across the street from you, so it's easy for all of us to be unaware of it or to forget about it if we heard it. I guarantee anyone who's listening to this a week from now, most of you will probably not remember that fact, because it didn't, you know, it's not happening in front of your face day in and day out. But yeah, the impacts, I mean, if you do a report card, just kind of to see where we stand in terms of our impact on the planet, it's pretty distressing, even though you and I can walk out our door every morning and everybody's behaving as if we're not in crisis. You can stop by the grocery store, there's food on the shelves, you turn on your faucet, there's water flowing, you know, you've got a job, you've got a paycheck, most of us, and life seems to be okay. But if you kind of step back and pay more attention to the news, you will know that we're deforesting the planet, we're depleting fertile soils, you know, at an alarming rate. We're turning fertile farmland into desert, and we're only able to grow food today because we're artificially, you know, boosting the soil with artificial nitrogen fertilizer and with phosphorus in order to grow the next crop. And with each passing year, the soil is you know more and more sterile, and there's less and less of it. But we just haven't run out. We haven't yet run out of the phosphorus and the fossil fuels that are keeping that going. We're the world's fisheries are declining at an alarming rate. The big fish that we used to eat are gone. They're just history. And we've got over 400 ocean dead zones that mostly result from all the runoff from the agriculture, the way that we do grow our food with this nitrogen fertilizer. We're killing fish once that water that washes down out of the farmland reaches the oceans. We're pushing other species off the planet. You know, the estimates really vary. I think the most recent one I saw was 3 or 4 species an hour are going extinct. No one really knows the exact rate that's happening at. We are pumping the world's aquifers dry to support agriculture, and we're really pumping most of the world's major rivers dry as well. Here in the U.S., half of the fresh water in the U.S. is deemed unfit to support life because of just the sheer amount of chemicals that end up in our rivers and lakes, because there's 320 million people in the U.S., you know, flushing all kinds of crap down their toilets. So when you look at that, and that's, you know, just off the top of my head, the evidence is pretty clear that we've outgrown the planet. We've outgrown the U.S., most countries have outgrown the carrying capacity of their own nation, and certainly with 7.4 billion people on planet Earth, we've outgrown the planet. The most serious scientific estimates of how many people planet Earth can really sustain over the long haul all tend to congregate, you know, and maybe they average around 2 billion. Some are far less, some are a little more, but we're, you know, way beyond 2 billion today. So we're living on borrowed time right now.
Yeah, and this is something people don't really see or understand. You know, one thing, I live, you know, right next to a state park, or basically almost really inside the state park. It's, I'm very blessed. But I grew up in Cincinnati, and I can remember not seeing the forest, and I think it takes a toll on our psychology. Living in an environment that has nothing natural, I think it leads to a kind of emotional stress. Have you ever experienced that?
Well, I try hard to make sure I don't experience that. I really love nature, and so I try to get out into nature as much as possible. But you really have put your finger on, you know, one of the fundamental problems that have gotten us where we are, and that is we have increasingly become urbanized and increasingly centralized things like, you know, production of food. And so today, the children that are growing up today see a lot less nature than you and I did when we were growing up, and we saw less nature probably than our parents did. You know, I was a free-range kid. I was outside from sunrise to sunset, and today's kids are mostly looking at, you know, playing games on computers or cell phones or watching television. And so there's something called nature deficit disorder that is one part of the problem. But also when we're not reminded daily about our dependence on nature, we tend to forget that we depend on it. You know, a lot of people think that food, where does food come from? They think it comes from the supermarket.
Right.
It really doesn't. It comes from the land, you know. But we, you know, we don't know that, and so it makes it easier for us to foul up the land, you know, because we don't see it. We're not living on it. It's, you know, we're not putting our fingers in the dirt every day, and so that's definitely making it harder for us to live sustainably, which we're nowhere close to doing.
I've never heard that before. There is something called nature deficit disorder now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
could
I can't really. I don't really have a lot of expertise there, so I can't give you a lot of details about it, but it's definitely been written about and documented. So if your listeners would Google it, you'll find some very interesting reading about it. And I don't know. The only impacts that I really know are the ones that I just described to you, but I'm sure there are others. And, you know, I would guess that even just stress is a part of it. You know, the natural world that we have created is pretty stressful. It's pretty high-paced, and, nature is not fast-paced. Nature is
not
quiet.
At all.
Yeah, it's quiet, and it's slow, and it's just, you know, it's relaxing. There is something really satisfying and healing about being in nature, but it's getting harder and harder to experience that.
Mm. You know, the other thing that people don't realize, something I've found in my research, is that forests moderate the weather. And I'm still doing research in this, but I find it fascinating. I should probably put some of these links in the chat room. But, for example, the albedo of a surface is defined as the ratio of the radiation that's reflected from the surface. Now, forests have real low albedos, and that means they absorb a lot of that incoming solar radiation, and they become warmer, and then that warms the area around and above them. And I think this is one of the ways that forests can help things to stay a little warmer in the winter. And there are other ways forests moderate the weather that I've found is that when the wind blows horizontally, the forests create kind of a turbulence because of the rough surface of the trees, and this moves the winds up. It slows the horizontal movement of the winds, and it tends to promote rains. I just wondered if any of your research has confirmed any of the things that I'm kind of talking about here as far as forests.
Well, you're teaching me something about the forest, so I didn't know that. I thought for a minute that you were maybe heading toward heat island effect, which is in another kind of the opposite of that, and that is that cities tend to have a lot of asphalt and a lot of concrete, and so they absorb tremendous amounts of heat, and in fact, a city can be as much as 4 degrees hotter than the natural surroundings outside the city.
Interesting.
Yeah, but that almost flies in the face of this idea about the forests being absorbing and warming. So I'm not, I have to admit, I'm not really familiar with that.
Well, you know, I think when we destroy the forest, there's still so much we don't know. You know, instead of, you know, doing the research to find out, hey, you know, what's going to happen if we cut all these trees down? You know, we just go ahead and do it. Cut the trees down, build the condominiums or whatever. And I think that there's a whole lot of things that we could be screwing up that we're not aware of. At least that's my take on it.
Well, I think, you know, some of us are aware that we are, you know. I think there are a lot of things, you're right, that are unknown. But there are plenty of things that are known that we're screwing up. I guess the things that are unknown are probably countless species and a lot of medicinal resources, especially in the rainforests of South America, for example. There's just so much that we haven't had a chance to explore, and we're losing that at a pretty alarming rate. And what we do know about it is that, at the very least, that those masses of trees do a heck of a job of kind of managing our atmosphere, managing our climate. And so as we cut those down, it's going to, you know, it just makes it that much harder, a lot harder for us to have a climate that's going to be hospitable for us to live in.
One of the listeners asks if you have ever heard of something called earthing. Does that ring a bell?
It does not. Earthing.
Earthing. I've not heard of that either.
I hope they'll enlighten us. It sounds like it might be something good.
Put something in the chat room, Barbara. we'll learn something here. But the whole thing of overpopulation it's a scary thing. What do you think the population of the world should be at? I mean, the research I've done, I'd be much happier if we were at about a billion or maybe a little less. What are your thoughts?
Well, you know, I don't put a lot of time into trying to figure out what I think might be the right number because I just know that it's far less than it is today. So I know what direction we want to go. You know, it'll be a while before we get down into the neighborhood we want to be in. So we have plenty of time to try to figure out what we think might be ideal. But I have looked at all of the, you know, the most respected scientists and what they're thinking. And, you know, like I think I mentioned something about 2 billion, and that's kind of been mentioned as the best, a few scientists' best estimate of how many people living at a modest European lifestyle could be sustained. And the reason they mention that is because it matters a lot how we're living. If we wanted to come up with a number worldwide of how many people the planet Earth can support over the long haul living like, you know, at the average American, the number would be way, way below a billion because we live big. We live high on the hog.
Sure.
The typical footprint of European, I think, is about half of our footprint. So you would take the 2 billion and at least divide it in half and get down to 1 billion. I do know some scientists who think the planet could only support 50 million people. I think that's on the extreme end. Yeah, I don't know. I only know one or two people who think 50 million is the magic number. But you said it's scary. And I just want to say, you know, it can be. And one of the reasons that we haven't really tackled the problem is because it's scary, and it's scary kind of based on some misassumptions we have. And one of the, you know, a couple of the big ones that really keep us from doing anything about it are that we assume that there's nothing we can do about it, that it's just inevitable, it's nature, and we can't change it. And we assume that if we did try to change it, that it would take a long, long time to bring human population back to a sustainable level. And one of the things that really got me excited about world population balance was the research and the math that David Paxson and the wonderful staff at World Population Balance did, plus a few volunteers around the world, and they determined that it really isn't mathematically that tough, that we could actually, just in 100 years, we could be back below 3 billion people and well on our way toward a billion people without having to kill anybody, you know, just by reducing our family size, just by voluntarily and humanely saying, you know what, we got a problem here. We want to have a good planet. We want our children to have a decent chance at good lives. So we're going to exercise some reproductive moderation and get the average family size way down. The closer we could get the global average fertility down to one, the more quickly we could get world population down below 3 billion and on its way to 2 billion. It's mathematically very doable. What makes it challenging is just politically it's challenging, and it's challenging just because people don't like to talk about it. They think there's this inalienable human right to make as many babies as you want. So don't you dare come into my bedroom and tell me how many babies I can make.
Is the challenge getting the third world to slow down their population rate, though? Isn't that where some of the problem comes in?
Well, the developing world is definitely where the highest fertility rates are, and that is a significant part of the challenge. But that is also one of the things that works against us, is that a lot of people tend to think that that's where the problem is. The problem isn't in the U.S. or Canada or Australia. And I think we'll have better luck when we start looking in the mirror, too, because The U.S., for example, with our 320 million people, we're actually appropriating about a quarter of the world's resources to meet our needs and our wants. So we're living way beyond our means here in the U.S. And that means we are over. That means that we either need to really simplify our lives, or we need to really reduce our numbers, or we need to do a little bit of both. And so even though our fertility rate in the U.S. is really not, it's not very far off of replacement level, the fact is we're way overpopulated. We've got over 100 million people, too many already. And so I really try to be an equal opportunity overpopulation advocate and say that, there's hardly a country in the world that isn't overpopulated. We all need to be working at it. And in fact, if you want to have an immediate impact on making the world a little bit safer and more livable for your children and their grandchildren, you actually can make a bigger difference by choosing to have one fewer child than someone in Nigeria will make, because the footprint of your child will be so much bigger than the footprint of someone in the developing world. So the problem's worldwide. It's definitely in the developing world, because no one wants to sentence the people in the developing world to continue to live in poverty for the rest of their lives. They want to live better lives, and we don't want to prevent that. So that means those huge numbers that they are in the process of generating are going to be a huge problem in the future. So we want to work on that, but we need to clean up our own backyard at the same time. And if we do that, the people in sub-Saharan Africa might be a little more inclined to take our advice. If we're following our own advice, they might be inclined to pay a little more attention to us.
You bring up a really good point there about the footprint. The way I have looked at it before is, I just looked around in my house and I thought of all the things that are made in factories, like your computer, your printer, your microwave, your refrigerator, your garage door, your garage door opener, your automobile. I mean, you can go on and on and on. And all of these things that we have, these conveniences, they have to be built in factories. And if you create a factory, then you've got to have roads to the factory, and you've got to have trucks to bring things in and out. So I think sometimes we really don't even think about the size of our footprint the way you put it. I like the way you put that.
Yeah, we don't think about that, but it is, ecological footprint is a great method of analysis that a really smart guy named William Rees in Canada developed, along with one of his students, a guy named Matisse Walker-Nagel. And they wrote a great book called, I think it's called Your Ecological Footprint, if I remember correctly. His student, Matisse Walker-Nagel, went on to found the Global Footprint Network, and this organization does great work. Every year they're working around the clock to do their best to measure, and where they can't exactly measure, to come up with the best estimates of what is the footprint of humanity and what's the footprint of every nation on the planet. And they, every 2 years, we get a report on that, on how we're doing. Are we, is our footprint getting bigger? Is it getting smaller? Who are the biggest pigs on the planet, so to speak? They don't use that language, but I do. And, the news isn't usually good. And the U.S. is not the worst, but I think we're like this, we're usually in second or third place. We're way up there.
Do you think China's the worst? Still there?
Well, I think that their rankings are on a per capita basis. So China wouldn't be, because the average Chinese citizen does not live nearly as high on the hog as we do. But of course, there are 1.4 billion people Chinese, so the country's total footprint is huge. But these guys, I think they divide it by population to come up with a per capita footprint, and that's why. I think Dubai or United Arab Emirates is at the top of the list, and U.S., Canada, Australia, we're at the top of the list of the biggest biggest pigs, and they say that I think in the last report they said that if the whole world lived like people in these top countries did, that we would need 4.5 or 5 planet Earths to meet our needs in order to keep us from basically withdrawing all the natural resources of the planet. Kind of what we're doing right now is we're having a liquidation sale. We're using resources faster than the planet can replenish every year. It would be like if you had a savings account and you were, if you wanted that savings account to last you for a long time, you wanted to retire young, you had a lot of money in there, you wanted to make sure that lasted you, you would make sure you just withdrew the interest, right?
Mm-hmm.
But if you started withdrawing principal, then you're on a, then you've lit the fuse, and at some point you're going to chew through everything in that savings account and there won't be anything left. And that's what we're doing right now. Instead of just living off the interest of the natural order of things, we're actually withdrawing some of the principal every year, which means that the planet Earth that could support maybe 2 billion this year at a modest European lifestyle, next year that number will be less because of the damage that we did
right.
This year. Because we were, mining stuff, pulling resources out of the earth faster than it's making them.
There's also a problem of desertification. Have you heard about that at all? It seems like we're creating bigger and bigger deserts too.
Yeah, you can't miss it. You look at the Middle East. It's hard to believe that used to be an oasis. That used to be the Garden of Eden. It was green, that's where we've been around the longest. So you can really see the damage that we do when we get carried away. Yep, we're definitely slowly converting the planet into desert. You go out and look. Go out and look at your breadbasket where they're growing. The most amazing crops this year, where you're getting your lettuce or your broccoli, at the rate we're going, eventually it'll be, just dried up nothingness.
It's interesting that you said Dubai was one of those places that's kind of bad or has a big footprint. Isn't Dubai, don't they have like just a beautiful city in a desert area? Are they reclaiming land from the ocean or something like that, or am I confused?
Well, I don't think you're confused. Yeah, they're such growth addicts that they don't have enough land, so they're making new land. They're dumping soil and concrete into the ocean in order to keep expanding that city rather than just saying, I think we'll just make do with what Mother Nature gave us. So I think that mentality doesn't surprise me that they would be high on the list.
So where are the biggest cities now, in China or in Japan or where?
Oh, man, you are really putting me to the test here. Well, let's see. We've got, certainly China has India have some of the biggest. Hong Kong and Singapore are up there. I don't really know where Mexico City comes in the scale.
Oh, I think that's pretty high. Isn't it around 20 million in Mexico City? Something like that?
Right. Something like that.
That's
yeah.
incredible. And isn't there this gigantic, like a slum around the city as well, I've heard?
Well, most
is that
of
true?
Them are. Yeah, what's happening is people are moving to the cities, in record numbers, and even the poor, because they're in for a number of reasons being pushed off of the land, and it's too bad. They would be better off if they could stay on the land, stay close to the land where they can grow food, which is what they need. But increasingly China and the U.S. are buying and appropriating the agricultural capacity of land in Africa, and so even people in Africa are moving, leaving the farms and moving to the city, and they end up in these, shanty towns, at the mercy of, somebody, please give me a job. At least
right.
If you're, if you're farming the land, you're not waiting for someone to give you a job. You got a job. You go out there
mm-hmm.
and you farm the land and you get to,
mm-hmm.
and you get to eat the food. Once you're in the slums of a big city, you are at the mercy of the economic system that, isn't turning out to be I don't think we've quite figured out the best economic system just yet.
No, I don't think so either. You know, one of the countries that Frosty Wooldridge talks about is Bangladesh, a country the size of Iowa that has like 167 million people living in it. To me, that's a huge example of overpopulation. Are there any other examples like that?
Well, you know, I mentioned Nigeria, Chad, you know, places in India like, used to be New Delhi. What's it called now? Mumbai.
Mumbai, huh?
You know, yeah, those are not, for the most part, those are, unless you are extraordinarily wealthy, those are not pleasant places to be. There, you know, if you go there, they are a good example of the sea of humanity, the morass of humanity that is not being, whose needs are not being met.
Another thing I've heard, I don't know if you've heard this statistic or not, is that roughly 4 million people are born on the street and die on the street in India every year.
I hadn't heard that.
That's a staggering figure to me.
Well, when you have
another
over a billion
one is,
people, that's easy.
Huh?
You know, when you have over a billion people, it's not that hard to get that kind of number.
I know. And I've heard that, 18 million people starve to death every year in the world?
That
Is
sounds
that
low to me.
Really?
You know, I can't say for sure. Yeah, I can't say for sure that's right. I know that about a billion people are undernourished. A billion.
Wow.
Yeah. Not all of them starve to death, but I would think it would be a larger percentage of that billion.
You know, another big problem that we have right now is water shortages. And some of the, I don't know if you've heard of the Ogallala Aquifer in the Great Plains. I think that thing is depleted. Today, its average depth is like 80 feet, and it used to have an average depth of 240 feet. So have you done any research on the depletion of our aquifers?
I can't help but notice that. Ogallala is a great example because that is, you know, this massive aquifer under the, you know, the central U.S., the breadbasket of the U.S., where a lot of our farms are. And the latest estimates that I've seen are that aquifer will basically be finished. It'll be done in 20 to 30 years.
Jeez.
You know, there'll still be a few people in a few places that can, you know, pump a little bit of water out of it, but for the most part, we won't be getting any more water out of it. And that means, you know, those farms are done.
So do you think we're looking at a disaster in 20 to 30 years, something like that?
Well, it could be a disaster if we don't get, you know, it will be a disaster if we don't get serious about tackling two things. And one of the big ones is overpopulation. You know, we could, like I said, within 100 years, we could be well on our way down to under 3 billion. And that means, you know, tomorrow, you know, if we said, you know what, we're going to get serious about this tomorrow, 9 months later, then we start seeing results. You know, 9 months later, we have that many fewer children being born. And it's not that I hate children. I don't hate children. I love children. I want our children to inherit a great world and have a chance at a decent life. And that just means that we have to stop adding so many of them every day, every month, every year. If we got started on that right away, you know, we might be able to stave off the worst of the catastrophic conditions. We can certainly push them out a little farther. If we continue to ignore it, when will the catastrophe hit? You know, I've heard, you know, I talk to the smartest people in the world about these kind of subjects every week. And I've heard some people think it could be 5 years. Seriously.
Really?
People that I respect and trust think that it could be just 5 years away. Some people think, well, it might be 10, 20, 30 years. They're all pretty honest, and they're too smart to say, you know, I'm going to, you know, pin the tail on the donkey here and say 7.5 years from now, the, you know, what hits the fan, because it's really impossible to predict with any certainty. But The smartest people in the room are saying, you know, I'd say they're saying 5 to 40 years, the world is going to really look a lot different, and we're going to be surprised. And I think that's,
so
that's
what
based
are your
on
thoughts on
doing nothing.
What are
if
your thoughts on immigration? Do you think we ought to just stop all immigration for a while and try to stabilize things here? I'm real concerned about immigration.
Well, you might not like my answer about immigration because, you know, what I'm going to say about it is that it is a subject that we would have to have, you know, we'd have to have a whole hour just to talk about.
Okay.
So I'm reluctant to have a 5-minute conversation about it. It is definitely
okay.
It definitely has a place in all this, but it isn't. You know, it's not the most significant part of the problem. The most significant part of the problem is globally for us to voluntarily and humanely start, you know, conceiving fewer children. That is huge. So that's so much bigger than how we're moving people around the planet. I would love to talk about immigration sometime, but I know it's just there's so much baggage, so many misassumptions, including some really fundamental misassumptions that drive almost everybody's thoughts about the subject. It would be pretty awesome to have a full hour to really unpack that one.
Sure, we can do that sometime. Do you think that multiculturalism is difficult? Is it something that nations can do easily? Or does that steer off even to a different discussion?
Well, it's definitely off. It's definitely off the message map of world population balance. I'm always tempted to answer just about any question anyone throws at me, but it's definitely getting it's a distraction. It certainly plays into the immigration dialogue. And I'll just say this: I'll say, you know, we are. We're a small group animal. Our long history is that we kind of roamed as hunter gatherers in bands of 100 people or less. And today we're way out of our comfort zone because we haven't, you know, socially adapted as fast as we've changed the planet. It doesn't really surprise me that we are a little bit tribal. You know, we do. Everybody's is more comfortable in their culture, and so it doesn't surprise me that there are people who don't like multiculturalism and think that they want to preserve their culture. My thinking though is that train's kind of left the station. You know, we've got this global civilization today, and there's just. It's kind of a melting pot, pretty much everywhere. So I don't see that as a huge thing. I don't see it as something we can do anything about.
What about? Do you think overpopulation leads to crime, war, and addiction? Addiction, possibly.
You know, overpopulation leads to just about everything that you might want to complain about in any given week. Have you ever seen the movie? There's this old Charlton Heston movie called Soylent Green.
Oh, yeah, I love that movie.
Remember that
movie?
You know, when that was made, they called it science fiction, and that just, you know, it was really almost laughable. And, in fact, when people watch it today, they laugh at it. But, you know, with each passing year, we are getting eerily closer to living that.
Sure.
When you think about it.
This
was a civilization where, you know, you had to step over bodies on the stairs, you know, and to get up to your apartment, and people were rioting in the streets when their food rations weren't delivered on time, and the way they were dealt with is, you know, these big dump trucks would move in and just scoop people up and dump them into the bed and drive them off. I mean, you were this faceless, nameless, anonymous, you know, you were just a bug crawling on the planet. And that's where we're slowly headed. We got a ways to go, and we still have an option to rescue ourselves and change course. But if we don't, you know, slowly we're going to get there. But the problem is we're doing it just slowly enough that, you know, most people don't notice it.
You know, when you were talking about Soylent Green there, it made me think about how much roadkill there is. I don't know if it's that way where you live, but, you know, every time I see another dead raccoon or another dead deer, it just bothers me. It's horrible.
Well, it's kind of just, that's a kind of a close to home evidence of, you know, how we're pushing species off the planet. You know, we don't think about that, but, you know, each new subdivision, you know, there are prairie dogs that are displaced or killed. You know, if they're displaced, they're moved somewhere else where they have to compete with more prairie dogs for less land. Or in Australia, in the case of Australia, it's koalas. There's this, you know, huge movement in Australia to try to save the koalas, because the urbanization along the eastern coast of Australia is just decimating the koala population. Here in the U.S., of course, I don't know. There are a number of populations. I think in Colorado, the Preble's Meadow jumping mouse. You know, it's not something you hear about. You don't see them on posters, but they're disappearing. We've, you know, had those challenges with grizzly bear and wolf populations, and you know, up in the Arctic with polar bear populations. And sometimes you see a little bit of news that makes you think that we're making some headway on some of these, but over the long haul, the trends are not in a positive direction, because, you know, you got 7.4 billion people and you're adding 200,000 more every day. You got to find a place to put them. They want a house, they want a place to shop, they want a place to work.
What part of the country are you in? You're in Eastern time zone, right?
No, I'm in Mountain time zone. World Population Balance, our headquarters is in Minneapolis, but I work remotely. I live in Colorado.
Okay.
So I live in an awesome place where, I found some bear scat on the sidewalk outside my house a couple of weeks ago.
Wow. That's great.
And I see deer every day, right outside my office window. It's great.
That's really good. I have a long commute into Columbus, Ohio. So from where I'm at, it's very beautiful, rolling hills and trees and a lake out here. But, you know, I get closer and closer to Columbus, and, you know, the traffic has gotten incrementally worse every year. And I work in a, you know, kind of a high-rise building, and, you know, a lot of times I get to work early, and I can just see this massive fleet of cars with, you know, the lanes both directions. It's just overwhelming. So overpopulation is quite an issue that we really have to get our minds wrapped around. But I don't think the public really is not convinced yet. What are your thoughts? Are people learning about the problem? What do you think?
Well, I'm so glad you asked that. That's a really great observation and a really great question, because one is, there has been we've in the sustainable population advocacy movement, we've called it the population taboo. There has been this taboo on discussing population growth and overpopulation for a couple of decades. You know, back in 1968, Paul Ehrlich and his wife Anne published a book called The Population Bomb, and that sort of set off a lot of public conversation about overpopulation. Great book, great couple of great scientists, and for a while it was in the public dialogue. We were really talking about it, and in fact, I was a teenager at that time, and so that made an impression on me, and so I made a point of, as soon as I had two kids, I was off to the urologist to get a vasectomy, because I was stopping it too. I was going to do my part not to contribute to overpopulation. Of course, now if I knew better back then, I probably would have stopped at one, because that would have been even better. But anyway, Along the line, a number of things happened to make it harder to talk about the subject. There was the China's one-child policy was implemented really poorly. There were a lot of human rights violations and quotas and things, and that became ugly, and that made sustainable population a less popular subject. Immigration, you know, people trying to get their own country to take responsibility for the size of its own country, which I think is an admirable environmental, sustainable kind of thing to do. Unfortunately, you know, got all this other baggage attached to it, so that it made it. If I told somebody, you know, like when my Growth Busters documentary came out, you know, for some people, if I said I've got a documentary about overpopulation, the first thing they might think is, oh, boy, they're probably going to talk about immigration in there. That's ugly. We don't want to go there. We're not going to show that film. I really didn't have a chance to even address immigration in that film. It would have had to have been its own film. But unfortunately, immigration is gets associated with it, and it's a part of it. And there's been some ugly, you know, there are some ugly parts of immigration. There are, you know, some people who are really up in arms about limiting immigration numbers are do have motives that don't really come from the angels of our better nature. Back in 94, women of the world kind of got up in arms and said, we're kind of tired of all these men telling us, you know, what to do with our bodies and telling us that we need to have fewer kids. And so the women's movement got involved too. And so it just became, you know, it became taboo. It just was an unpopular subject and got brushed under the rug. And for a couple of decades, it was really hard to have a, you know, rational conversation about overpopulation. I see really promising signs just in the last few years that we're breaking out of that. We're having, you know, there have been enough really intelligent people who have figured out how to have these conversations without, you know, violating human rights. There's so much about this that is all about human rights and is about women's rights. And so I am feeling pretty optimistic that the subject is being moved back to the front burner as it really needs to be. So had a couple of dark decades, but it's looking better.
Oh, excellent. Well, Dave, we're about out of time. Did you want to tell people about your website, your documentary, and I don't know, do you have a book?
You know, I don't, but I'll try. If I don't run out of time, I'll tell you about a couple of new books that are on my radar screen. First of all, worldpopulationbalance.org. Great website. Some of the best frequently asked questions about population are answered there. And we have an awesome thing called the Sustainable Population Pledge that's really going gangbusters, where people can actually sign a pledge to do their part to have a small family. And I would encourage listeners to check that out and share that. There's a new novel that was just published this month called Patriarch Run by Benjamin Dancer that has overpopulation as one of the themes, and I think it's a really entertaining book. Next week, there's actually a webinar with Benjamin Dancer and Alan Weissman, who wrote a really great nonfiction book called Countdown, one of the best books about overpopulation. Alan and Benjamin and I are going to be talking about the end of the population taboo. And I think if you go to growthbusters.org/webinars, you can find information to register for that. It's a free webinar. And we'll be talking about that. We'll be answering your last question about is the population taboo behind us, and if so, what kind of opportunity does that represent?
Fantastic, Dave. I appreciate you coming on the show. I think this is probably the biggest problem in the world right now.
No question. It's the root. It is really the root of so many of our problems. And I forgot to get into to go back to the traffic jam problem with you. We'll have to do that in another episode, perhaps, because people think all we need is more buses or trains or another lane. They never think we need fewer babies, unfortunately.
All right, Dave. We'll talk to you soon. Have a good evening.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Bye.